the stillness carry me. Find the silence, hold the silence, let the silence carry me. In the Spirit, by the Spirit, with the Spirit giving power, I will find true harmony. Seek the essence, hold the essence, let the essence carry me. Let me flower, help me flower, watch me flower, carry me. In the Spirit, by the Spirit, with the Spirit giving power, I will find true
. So as Kathy explained, our service today is a collection of readings from the Church of the Larger Fellowship, and Kathy is going to lead off our readings with a poem by a musician who we've quoted here before. I'll invite Kathy up now.
Hi. The title is God is No Noun by Glenn Thomas Rideout. God is no noun and certainly not an adjective. God is at least a verb, and even that shrinks her. God is not so much a woman as she resides in the improbable hope of brown mothers. God is not so much a man as he is at work in the memory of my grandfather's laugh. God is not trans. God swims in the tears of the one who sees her real self long at last in the bathroom mirror. God is not black, neither is he white. God is waiting in the contradiction of songs from the slave shacks. And I've seen God in the alabaster smiles of children at play. We're getting Michelangelo all wrong. God is not the bearded one surrounded by angels floating over the Sistine. He is not Adam with his muscled back pressing the earth. No, God is the closing inch of space between their reaching fingers. Don't believe for a moment that God is Catholic. For God's sake, he isn't even human. Have you heard the wood thrush when the sun glistens the heron? Can you see the flowers, how they speak to the bees without a word? Still, God is no spring blossom nor wood thrush. God is neither the sun nor the bee. God is what you see in the blossom. God is what you hear, the river, and suddenly discover how much of it is a part of you. To be clear, God is not you. God is somewhere in the 14 billion years which have come to mean that you are. God is, after all, at least a verb. She is neither Pharaoh's rod nor Moses' staff. We must be the ones to cease our slavery. She is not interested in blame, neither does she offer praise. Truth, gratitude are ours to breathe. She will not have your answers. She is too large for that. She dances too wildly to be fastened to them, and answers are nouns anyway. God is at least a verb, twirling in the radiant reds of spring blossoms, singing in the rare silence between the rapid opinions, attending the tears of dark-skinned deaths, and learning in the tiny alabaster smiles. God is waiting in the space between fingers that might connect. God is waiting for us. Stop naming her. She's waiting for us to see all of him. God is waiting to be unshrunk. Thank you. Matthew, would you like to come up next? Thanks.
Why not? Let's see if I can do this without sneezing.
Oh, I bet you can.
Okay, this is Face to Face with Mystery by Reverend Christine Robinson. So you've got a bunch of really pressing, life-changing, love-soaked problems, and you've tied yourself up in knots of anxiety. Desperate for relief, perspective, and a change, you take yourself to the foothills to walk. You stump along for an hour, rehearsing your options, your anxieties, your angers and fears, and finally you drop into an exhausted inner silence. You mount the crest of a hill and notice, down the pathways, a family of deer close enough that you can see their beautiful eyes. You come to a startled halt, and for one moment, every fiber of your being is simply present. The deer look at you, you look at them. A smile plays on your lips, perhaps the first smile in days. A weight drops from your shoulders, and you watch in wonder, feeling somehow deeply related to these companions and their peaceful ways. The deer amble off. You resume your walk, but it's all different now. The weight is gone. The anger and anxiety lessened. You find yourself thinking, it's going to be all right. Whatever happens, it will be all right. There's no logical reason for you to think this. Your problems are just as dire as they were an hour ago. But you have no doubt of this larger wisdom. And the most important part of your problems, your reaction to them, has changed, and you are content to simply do what seems best and await the outcome. Your spouse died yesterday in a sudden accident away from home. The police came to your door. It was all over. You did all the things one must do in such cases with calm demeanor and dry eyes and fell into bed that night, physically and emotionally numb and exhausted. Later, you awaken to see a bunch of magnetic alphabet letters on the floor beside your bed. You know you are awake, and you know there are no such things by your bed, or in your house, for that matter. And as you watch, the letters shift around and arrange themselves to form the word L-O-V-E. You know that this is the doing of your spouse. You know this in spite of the fact that you don't believe in an afterlife, or spirits, or souls, or anything beyond what we can see or touch in this material world. I love you too, you say through your tears, and then the letters are gone. You get up, make tea, weep, and then the next day you go to see your minister. You want her to tell you that it was just a dream, or a grief reaction, or incipient schizophrenia, because frankly, even that would seem preferable to having a lifetime's philosophical underpinnings knocked out from under you. But when you get there and you tell your story and she asks you what you think you were going on, you say, absolutely sure of yourself, it was him. It just felt like him. I can't explain it, but I know it. And instead of telling you that it's just your grief, she tells you how glad she is that you had that experience. She had heard stories like that before, she says, enough to have her come to believe that our world is wider and more mysterious than anything we can explain. You can tell her that explaining things is very important to you, but she just encourages you to enjoy the fact that you had that last goodbye with your beloved. that understanding it is not necessary and may not be possible, and you both weep together. A mystic is a person who, first and foremost, relies on their own inner experience to decide what is true and meaningful in their lives. For that reason, mystics are looked at with some suspicion in traditions that value priests, scripture, and tradition. Mystics often find themselves accused of heresy. That is to say, they're guilty of choosing their beliefs based on their own inner authority rather than relying on external authorities. That's what heresy means. Choosing, especially choosing what people who think they have authority over you tell you is wrong. Think Joan of Arc. But you know, it seems to me that mystical experience is right down the UU alley. We give religious and spiritual authority to individuals and ask each person to look at their own mind and heart, at their own experience of life, to choose how to express their own beliefs. We believe that the divine speaks uniquely into the hearts of individuals, and that those encounters with mystery and wonder form one of the bases of our faith. Very heretical. Of course, mysticism, like any kind of rabid individualism, can lead you astray. There are other kinds of inner experiences that arise out of our wounded or damaged or ill selves, and it can be important and helpful to confide in others to get their perspective when we have questions. But very often seems that mystical experiences feel, and indeed are, the true to the one who has them. Often they change lives for the better. So all that I ask of you, rationalistic, heretical, feet planted firmly on the ground folks, is to base your faith on the whole of your experience, even the parts you can't explain. There are encounters with mystery and wonder. After all, not equations on the math test. The point is not to explain and solve. The point is to ask yourself what you've learned and what kind of meaning that gives to your life. And to do that, you have to start by expecting these experiences to happen, and then to remember, cherish, and ponder them when they do come along. Let your experiences connect you to the rest of the world's religious people. Let them guide your life, comfort you in difficulty, help you make decisions, and mold the philosophy of your life. Let them lead you in the path of mystery and wonder.
Thank you, Matthew Stillman. That was wonderful. Linda, would you like to?
This is called Resources for Living by Reverend Dr. Lynn Unger. As part of trying to define who we are and what we are called to do, Unitarian Universalists have come up with not only seven principles that list the things we covenant to affirm and promote, but also a list of six sources of our living tradition. And the very first item on this list of where we come from is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. That's quite a mouthful for a person of any age, so let's break it down a bit. This first building block of our UU tradition is not Christianity or Judaism or any of the world's many sacred traditions or texts. The starting place for who we are comes from each and every one of us, our own direct experience. It's not something that anyone else can give us or take away. And this statement, the first source of our living faith, declares that everyone in every culture has experiences of mystery and wonder. Whoever you are, or Whether or not you would say that you believe in God or gods, you have had some kind of experience of touching mystery. Maybe it was looking up at a sky full of stars and remembering just how small each of us is in this unimaginably huge universe. Maybe it was witnessing the birth of a child or the death of someone you loved. Maybe it was sitting in the crook of a giant tree or hearing music that engulfed and held you, or reading a poem that you couldn't explain but totally understood in your heart. Maybe it was watching a flock of birds swoop and turn all together in the air, as if each bird were just one cell in a larger body of its flock. Maybe you experienced mystery and wonder looking at or swimming in the ocean waves. We tend to think of mystery as meaning things we can't explain, and certainly there are mysteries in this to be solved, like in a whodunit novel where you want to figure it out so that the mystery isn't a mystery anymore. But really, our direct experience of mystery and wonder go far beyond the question of whether you can fully explain something, even scientifically. Astronomers know a tremendous amount about stars and planets and supernovas and black holes and galaxies and many more amazing features of our expanding universe. But all that knowledge only adds to the great mystery that each of us is somehow a living and complete conscious life, that we are creating our own story and loving and learning, even though we are so tiny in the scheme of things that you would think we didn't matter at all. Physics can explain the shape of a wave and how long it takes to curl over and crash on shore. But that doesn't detract from the sense of mystery and wonder you feel when you stand face to face with something so powerful and beautiful. Whatever our beliefs, whatever our knowledge, mystery and wonder belong not just to our human experience, but also to our human religious experience. That's what makes it a transcending mystery and wonder. When you transcend something, you go beyond a limit or a boundary, as in mercy transcends justice, or this chocolate decadence transcends all other desserts. Transcending mystery and wonder is something that moves beyond our ordinary categories of who we are and what life is like. That's religion. Religion starts with the experience of mystery and wonder that transcends all the everyday ways we categorize things by how they work and how they are useful to us. Transcending mystery and wonder starts with recognizing that we belong to something much bigger than ourselves, that we can only touch it in imagination and music and art. But it goes beyond that recognition to something more. The statement of our first source says that it moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. Experiencing mystery and wonder, remembering that we are connected to something bigger than we can completely explain or describe, does something to us or something for us. When we touch that mystery, we are somehow refreshed. We remember that whatever particular problems we're obsessing about at the moment are not the whole picture. We're just one drop in the wave, one bird in the swooping flock, one star or tiny planet in the great galaxy. We stop trying to make everything in life fit into the cramped box of our own small ideas about how things should be and let go into the mystery and the wonder of it all. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda Evans. Ellie, we invite Ellie Gordon up.
Thank you for standing there, just in case I fall when you pick me up. Well, thank you, Bill Hart, for this step. Okay, she's up here. This reading is from Meg Riley. Reverend Meg Riley, who
who is a senior minister at the Church of the Larger Fellowship. I Googled her name because I wanted just to read a little bit of more about her personally. I've read some things from her, but I wanted to find out about her. And she's out in Minneapolis, out in Minnesota, and was born somewhere in Virginia, someplace called Charleston, Virginia. I didn't know there was a Charleston in Virginia, too. Her father worked for a company that moved them around, not IBM, but something like that. And eventually they ended up further north and west. This one is titled, "We Have a Mystery on Our Hands." My physicist father drove me crazy. I would ask him what rainbows were made of. And by the time he had pontificated for 15 or 20 minutes, I would be desperately bored. "Sorry, I ask," squirming to get away. The rainbow itself, of course, would be long gone. Later, I drove him crazy, too. Year after year, I would gift him with books like The Tao of Physics, The Dancing Wu Li Masters, and other popular books that turned physics into something of a, well, a religion. He would thank me politely. After he died, I brought all those never-opened books back to my house. My father studied physics. It became apparent because it solved problems, and he liked that. Physics was orderly. Uninterested in scientific theories that bordered on the mystical, he was brokenhearted that none of his four kids opted to study math or science. Once I told him with excitement, I was actually interested in the math theory class. This was because a student had told me that at their math class, they would start from the ground up, doing equations that were true, and then building on these truths, reach a point out over the horizon somewhere that was false. That, I told my father, was a truly compelling reason to study math. He studied my face as if to see if I was joking, and then said with more sadness than scorn, "That's the dumbest reason to study math I ever heard of." It wasn't only my father who responded to me this way. For the college thesis, I proposed to study Platonic dialogues. My particular interests were the times when Socrates pointed to a myth as an important source of learning rather than hammering away with question after question, because the myth was the closest thing to truth that could be uttered. My philosophy professor looked at me with about the same face my father had and then said simply, "It does not mean that." So I did what everyone who was met with such facial expressions did in those days. I studied English literature. Even that, though, I found a rather sad pursuit. Rather than look at how the whole piece of artistry was consistently greater than the sum of the parts, rather than pause to look in awe at the sheer beauty of a poem or novel, we picked them apart. Pick into such tiny particles that soon we didn't know what the whole thing even looked like. The only classes I really loved were allegory, where the words on the page pointed to something bigger behind the story, and romantic poetry, where the weather could represent how someone felt, and it was okay. Classes that let the mystery be. Where do students get to meditate on the mystery of life? Where are the schools for mystics? I am not at all sorry that prayer was taken out of public school, but I do think there's something good about pausing for a moment of gratitude for all that is life. I don't think intelligent design is real science, but I do share the impulse to marvel at the symmetry, at the eloquence, at the precision of nature, which points to something beyond the broken down particles. What I longed for was a world that offered both, that lifted up the beauty of the whole, pointed to the edges of what we could know, and still devoted itself to moving as far down the road of knowledge as the students could go. I like to think, I like to analyze what people are doing, and why, and how cultures are shaped, and how power is built and used, how patterns emerge. I like to learn how to use social media, how things work, and what bird species look and sound like. I like to be challenged intellectually and to think hard. Ooh, I like to read books and interesting magazines and consider something I never thought about before. None of that learning diminishes mystery for me. In fact, the more I learn, the more I see that I don't know. The more mystery emerges as a constant, the topics that I know the most are about the ones in which I am also the most aware of what I don't know. Socrates was declared the wisest man in Athens by the Delphic oracle because he knew that he knew nothing. My philosophy professor would say that Plato didn't mean that. I'd say he did. I'd say that my philosophy professor missed a great deal of what was interesting and beautiful and true by closing his mind to the mystery. As for me, I'm honestly not that interested in those cosmic physics books either. Is Brian in here? I'm going to trust that my ever-increasing acceptance of the mystery means I'm heading in the right direction, that I'm getting wiser. I don't need to research mystery. It finds me. I can go about my business trying to get along in the world, and I'll never be without it. A colleague told me that his 3-year-old son loves to quote Scooby-Doo. Looks like we have another mystery on our hands. This kid says it when things are broken and there's no mystery at all about who broke them. He says it when he really doesn't know something. I think this 3-year-old has the right idea. Looks like we have another mystery on our hands.
Each of the topics at Church of the Larger Fellowship gets made into a booklet. So if you do ever visit the site, you'll get to see these readings and the other ones from different, and the pictures of the people who wrote these. I am going to read one that comes from the minister down in the Mount Kisco Unitarian Congregation, Michael Tino, who is, I've been to some workshops with him. He's very interesting, very, yes, that's a wonderful word, ebullient, effusive, just bright guy in the light sense. His piece is called Mysterious Ways. When my husband Eric and I traded in our old cell phones for iPhones, we noticed a subtle but profound change in our lives. Wherever we go, we now have instant access to the internet in our pockets. With Google, Wikipedia, the Internet Movie Database, and other sites at our fingertips at all times, most questions that come up in conversations can be answered in a matter of moments. Our shorthand for this phenomenon is no mysteries. There are many fewer mysteries in our lives since this technology attached itself to our hips. And that's not always a good thing. You see, I love mystery. I love being surrounded by the unknown and the unknowable. I love living in a universe whose known parts are dwarfed by the immensity of parts yet to be discovered. I love being a human whose knowledge is just deep enough to reveal all things I do not know and never will. As a child, I devoured mystery books by the dozens, graduating quickly from the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew to Agatha Christie and beyond. I was invariably upset at the end when everything was so neatly tied together. What makes a good novel, I guess, isn't the stuff of real life, in which the right answers are, more often than not, never known. I'm pretty sure there's not a single book in which Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple gather people together at the end and pronounce, "I haven't the foggiest idea who did it." Now that would be a mystery, and I'd love it. I knew I'd found the right college for me when the required application essay asked me to ponder a question with no provable answer. I should have re-examined my intended major, though, when I wrote my essay on belief in God. It would have saved me lots of time. I became a scientist, not because I thought it would be a way to find answers, but because it was a field based on questions. I loved asking questions, probing their depths, removing successive layers of ignorance to reveal deeper and more numerous questions in every turn. I loved the mysteries of science. I loved making guesses at the unprovable, amassing evidence for the unseeable, moving deeper into the unthinkable, and asking more questions than I ever answered. I loved contributing to the mystery of the universe. Ultimately, the mysteries of science weren't enough for me, though. I moved on to being part of a greater mystery, into a greater question. What is the purpose of our existence? I know that there will never be an answer to that question that satisfies me. Rather than turning off from the pursuit, though, it ignites my love, my passion, and my drive. I am energized and fed by the pursuit of unprovable knowledge. I am inspired to pay closer attention to all that I experience, lest I miss a clue, a path to the ultimate, or an experience of the true. I love mystery, and I love thinking that there is an unknowable love that surrounds us all, a love that can be sensed, but whose source remains beyond our comprehension. It is this mysterious love that drives my ministry and asks me to seek connections with all of the beings with whom I share this universe. In their 1991 song, Mysterious Ways, the group U2 sang of a love that came from an unknown and unknowable source. Their song has the added bonus for me of mysterious meaning. People have debated for decades now whether the song is about love between two humans or the love of God, referred to in the feminine. The band members aren't saying. Good for them. In mysterious ways, they sing, "One day you'll look back and you'll see where you were held now by this love while you could stand there. You could move on this moment. Follow this feeling." That mysterious love holds us now, and yet we have no idea where it comes from. One day it might be clear, but for now, just go with it. Follow your feeling. Just kneel before it and make yourself humble in its presence. Wherever it comes from, whatever it means, whoever or whatever is its ultimate source, just let the love surround you. "It's all right," they conclude. "She moves in mysterious ways." Our last reading today will be from Susan and Judy.
We can be together, right? Yeah. Or should we not?
Together.
Forever.
Are you there, God? It's me, Meg.
Yes, and if you don't mind, I'll keep calling you Margaret. It confuses me when young people always change to nicknames. It's hard enough learning the names of each of you.
Actually, I'm not that kid in Judy Blume's teen novel. Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. My name never was Margaret. I'm Meg, the senior minister at the Church of the Larger Fellowship. I thought if we hung out for a while, I could name drop in our newsletter.
Meg, it sounds like a nickname to me.
Well, you're a great one to talk. Isn't God a nickname? I mean, Yahweh is the initials of I am what I am. Talk about the ultimate confusing name.
I'll say, folks confuse me all the time. They confuse me with a judge. They confuse me with either or both of their parents. They're always confusing me with Santa Claus. And what makes me saddest of all is when they confuse me with the biggest bully.
Yeah, I think I've met some of those people. And maybe I've confused your name a few times myself. So will you help me to get it right?
I am what I am.
Well, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Does that mean you are thought?
Oh, you think too much. Don't blame that on me. Hey, that reminds me of a good joke that Stephen Colbert told. God is love. Love is blind. Stevie Wonder is blind. Therefore, God is Stevie Wonder. Isn't that good?
Well, some of Stevie Wonder's music would make me believe that. You watch the Colbert show? What else do you like to watch?
Oh, it's all a big show to me. On stage, off stage, behind the stage, I watch it all.
You mean like you see me when I'm sleeping? You know when I'm awake? You know when I've been good or bad, so be good for goodness sake?
Oh, no, that's Santa Claus. I told you, sometimes folks mix us up. And maybe why they keep thinking that I'm an old man with a beard.
Well, the old man with a beard thing is bigger than Santa. It's from the stories in the Hebrew Bible, I think. And then Michelangelo did those gorgeous paintings, and we all kind of imprinted on them.
Back in the day, after people stopped listening to the goddesses, people mostly listened to old men with beards. So that was how people visualized ultimate authority. These days, I'd be more likely to appear as a cellular network. That's where people put all their respect now.
Wait a minute. What? You're a cellular network? You mean 3G and 4G and the G stands for God?
No, I told you. You think too much. Of course it doesn't, but listen. Listen to the language used to describe just one network. Living, breathing intelligence. That sounds like my name.
If you are saying that living, breathing intelligence sounds like your name, how come you keep telling me I think too much?
Don't confuse thinking with intelligence, at least the way you use the words. Do plants think? Do stars? Do rocks?
Do they have intelligence?
Of course they do. Intelligence means understanding. When you've longed for complete understanding, haven't you ever stared at a star or walked among trees or held a rock?
Sure.
So you may have been bumping into me about then. But humans can have understanding too. Mostly it doesn't happen in your heads. It happens between you when suddenly your bodies don't hold you in separate containers. You're merged with others. That's what Jesus was trying to say when he said, "The kingdom of God is among you. I am between you in the love you show each other."
You mean we create you by loving each other?
We all co-create each other, right? Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going?
Mystery, mystery, life is a riddle and a mystery.
Now you're showing a little more understanding. Your energy shifted there.
That's because those are words from a song I love to sing with other people. It's in the UU hymnal.
There you have it. Singing is a great way to touch the energy between you and other people to create a little more intelligence. Look, Margaret, I gotta go. I hear the network is down in Washington, D.C. again.
Thanks, God. And you can call me Margaret. I guess the names don't really matter as much as the understanding.
Okay, before we have our congregational sharing, we're going to have another hymn. You are invited to stand as you are willing or able. And the hymn is 326. Let all the beauty we have known.